hour or so and were baffled by the procedure. "Why can't they hook the two jars up to each other and eliminate the middleman?" the artillery captain with whom Yossarian had stopped playing chess inquired. "What the hell do they need him for? I wonder what he did to deserve it," the warrant officer with malaria and a mosquito bite on his ass lamented after Nurse Kramer had read her thermometer and discovered that the soldier in white was dead.
"He went to war,"
the fighter pilot with a golden mustache surmised.
"We all went to war," Dunbar countered. "That's what I mean," the warrant officer with malaria continued. "Why him? There just doesn't seem to be any logic to this system of rewards and punishment. Look what happened to me. If I had gotten syphilis or a dose of clap for my 5 minutes of passion on the beach instead of this damn mosquito bite, I could see some justice. But malaria? Malaria? Who can explain malaria as a consequence of fornication?"
The warrant officer shook his head in numb astonishment.
"What about me?" Yossarian said. "I stepped out of my tent in Marrakesh one night to get a bar of candy and caught your dose of clap when that whack I never even saw before hissed me into the bushes. All I really wanted was a bar of candy, but who could turn it down?"
"That sounds like my dose of clap, all right," the warrant officer agreed. "But I've still got somebody else's malaria. Just for once, I'd like to see all these things sort of straightened out, with each person getting exactly what he deserves. It might give me some confidence in this universe."
"I've got somebody else's $300,000, the dashing young fighter captain with the golden mustache admitted. "I've been goofing off since the day I was born. I cheated my way through prep school and college, and just about all I've been doing ever since is shacking up with pretty girls who think I'd make a good husband. I got no ambition at all. The only thing I want to do after the war is marry some girl who's got more money than I have and shack up with lots more pretty girls. The $300,000 was left to me before I was born by a grandfather who made a fortune selling hogwash on an international scale. I know I don't deserve it, but I'll be damned if I give it back. Wonder who it really belongs to. Maybe it belongs to my father," Dunbar conjectured. "He spent a lifetime at hard work and never could make enough money to even send my sister and me through college. He's dead now, so he might as well keep it. Now, if we can just find out who my malaria belongs to, we'd be all set. It's not that I've got anything against malaria. I'd just as soon gold brick with malaria as with anything else. It's only that I feel an injustice has been committed. Why should I have somebody else's malaria and you have my dose of clap?"
"Oh, I got more than your dose of clap," Yossarian told him. "I got to keep flying combat missions because of that dose of yours until they kill me."
"That makes it even worse. What's the justice in that? I had a friend named Clevenger 2.5 weeks ago who used to see plenty of justice in it."
"It's the highest kind of justice of all," Clevenger had gloated, clapping his hands with a merry laugh. "I can't help thinking about the Hippolytus of Euripides, where the early licentiousness of Theseus is probably responsible for the asceticism of the son that helps bring about the tragedy that ruins them all. If nothing else, that episode with the whack should teach you the evil of sexual immorality."
"It teaches me the evil of candy."
"Can't you see that you're not exactly without blame for the predicament you're in?" Clevenger had continued with undisguised relish. "If you hadn't been laid up in the hospital with venereal disease for 10 days back there in Africa, you might have finished your 25 missions in time to be sent home before Colonel Nevers was killed and Colonel Cathcart came to replace him."
"And what about you?" Yossarian had replied. "You never got clap in Marrakesh, and you're in the same predicament."
"I don't know," confessed Clevenger with a trace of mock concern. "I guess I must have done something very bad in my time."
"Do you really believe that?"
Clevenger laughed.
"No, of course not. I just like to kid you along a little."
There were too many dangers for Yossarian to keep track of. There was Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo, for example, and they were all out to kill him. There was Lieutenant Shishkov with his fanaticism for parades, and there was the bloated colonel with his big fat mustache and his fanaticism for retribution, and they wanted to kill him, too.
There was Appleby, Havermeyer, Black, and Korn. There was Nurse Kramer and Nurse Duckett, who he was almost certain wanted him dead. And there was the Texan and the CID man, about whom he had no doubt. There were bartenders, bricklayers, and bus conductors all over the world who wanted him dead, landlords and tenants, traitors and patriots, lynchers, leeches, and lackeys, and they were all out to bump him off. That was the secret Snowden had spilled to him on the mission to Avignon. They were out to get him, and Snowden had spilled it all over the back of the plane. There were lymph glands that might do him in. There were kidneys, nerve sheaths, and corpuscles. There were tumors of the brain. There was Hodgkin's disease, leukemia, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. There were fertile red meadows of epithelial tissue to catch and coddle a cancer cell. There were diseases of the skin, diseases of the bone, diseases of the lung, diseases of the stomach, diseases of the heart, blood, and arteries. There were diseases of the head, diseases of the neck, diseases of the chest, diseases of the intestines, diseases of the crotch. There were even diseases of the feet. There were billions of conscientious body cells oxidating away day and night like dumb animals at their complicated job of keeping him alive and healthy. And every one was a potential traitor and foe. There were so many diseases that it took a truly diseased mind to even think about them as often as he and Hungry Joe did. Hungry Joe collected lists of fatal diseases and arranged them in alphabetical order so that he could put his finger without delay on any one he wanted to worry about. He grew very upset whenever he misplaced some or when he could not add to his list, and he would go rushing in a cold sweat to Dr. Nika for help. "Give him Ewing's tumor," Yossarian advised Dr. Nika, who had come to Yossarian for help in handling Hungry Joe, "and follow it up with melanoma. Hungry Joe likes lingering diseases, but he likes the fulminating ones even more." Dr. Nika had never heard of either.
"How do you manage to keep up on so many diseases like that?"
he inquired with high professional esteem.
"I learned about them at the hospital when I studied the Reader's Digest."
Yossarian had so many ailments to be afraid of that he was sometimes tempted to turn himself into the hospital for good and spend the rest of his life stretched out there inside an oxygen tent with a battery of specialists and nurses seated at one side of his bed 24 hours a day waiting for something to go wrong and at least one surgeon with a knife poised at the other, ready to jump forward and begin cutting away the moment it became necessary. Aneurysms, for instance. How else could they ever defend him in time against an aneurysm of the aorta? Yossarian felt much safer inside the hospital than outside the hospital, even though he loathed the surgeon and his knife as much as he had ever loathed anyone. He could start screaming inside a hospital, and people would at least come running to try to help. Outside the hospital, they would throw him in prison if he ever started screaming about all the things he felt everyone ought to start screaming about— or they would put him in the hospital. One of the things he wanted to start screaming about was the surgeon's knife that was almost certain to be waiting for him and everyone else who lived long enough to die. He wondered often how he would ever recognize the first chill, flush, twinge, ache, belch, sneeze, stain, lethargy, vocal slip, loss of balance or lapse of memory that would signal the inevitable beginning of the inevitable end. He was afraid also that Dr. Nika would still refuse to help him when he went to him again after jumping out of Major Major's office. And he was right.
"You think you've got something to be afraid about?"
Dr. Nika demanded, lifting his delicate, immaculate dark head up from his chest to gaze at Yossarian irascibly for a moment with lachrymose eyes.
"What about me? My precious medical skills are rusting away here on this lousy island while other doctors are cleaning up. You think I enjoy sitting here day after day refusing to help you? I wouldn't mind it so much if I could refuse to help you back in the States or someplace like Rome. But saying no to you here isn't easy for me either."
"Then stop saying no. Ground me."
"I can't ground you,"
Dr. Nika mumbled.
How many times do you have to be told?
Yes, you can. Major told me. You're the only one in the squadron who can ground me.
Dr. Nika was stunned.
Major told you that? When?
When I tackled him in the ditch.
Major told you that? In a ditch?
He told me in his office after we left the ditch and jumped inside. He told me not to tell anyone he told me. So don't start shooting your mouth off.
Why, that dirty, scheming liar, Dr. Nika cried. He wasn't supposed to tell anyone. Did he tell you how I could ground you?
Just by filling out a little slip of paper saying I'm on the verge of a nervous collapse and sending it to group. Dr. Stubbs grounds men in his squadron all the time. So why can't you?
And what happens to the men after Stubbs does ground them? Dr. Nika retorted with a sneer. They go right back on combat status, don't they? And he finds himself right up the creek. Sure, I can ground you by filling out a slip saying you're unfit to fly. But there's a catch.
Catch 22?
Sure. If I take you off combat duty, group has to approve my action. And group isn't going to. They'll put you right back on combat status. And then where will I be? On my way to the Pacific Ocean, probably. No, thank you. I'm not going to take any chances for you.
Isn't it worth a try? Yossarian argued. What's so hot about Pianosa?
Pianosa is terrible, but it's better than the Pacific Ocean. I wouldn't mind being shipped someplace civilized, where I might pick up a buck or two in abortion money every now and then. But all they've got in the Pacific is jungles and monsoons. I'd rot there.
You're rotting here.
Dr. Nika flared up angrily.
Yeah? Well, at least I'm going to come out of this war alive, which is a lot more than you're going to do.
That's just what I'm trying to tell you, goddammit. I'm asking you to save my life.
It's not my business to save lives,
Dr. Nika retorted sullenly.
What is your business?
I don't know what my business is. All they ever told me was to uphold the ethics of my profession and never give testimony against another physician. Listen, you think you're the only one whose life is in danger? What about me? Those two quacks I've got working for me in the medical tent still can't find out what's wrong with me.
Maybe it's Ewing's tumor,
Yossarian muttered sarcastically.
Do you really think so?
Dr. Nika exclaimed with fright.
Oh, I don't know, Yossarian answered impatiently. I just know I'm not going to fly any more missions. They wouldn't really shoot me, would they? I've got 51.
Why don't you at least finish the 55 before you take a stand?
Dr. Nika advised.
With all your bitching, you've never finished a tour of duty even once.
How the hell can I? The colonel keeps raising them every time I get close.
You never finish your missions because you keep running into the hospital or going off to Rome. You'd be in a much stronger position if you had your 55 finished and then refused to fly. Then maybe I'd see what I could do.
You promise?
I promise.
What do you promise?
I promise that maybe I'll think about doing something to help if you finish your 55 missions and if you get McWatt to put my name on his flight log again so that I can draw my flight pay without going up in a plane. I'm afraid of airplanes. Did you read about that airplane crash in Idaho 3 weeks ago? 6 people killed. It was terrible. I don't know why they want me to put in 4 hours flight time every month in order to get my flight pay. Don't I have enough to worry about without worrying about being killed in an airplane crash, too?
I worry about airplane crashes also, Yossarian told him. You're not the only one.
Yeah, but I'm also pretty worried about that Ewing's tumor, Dr. Nika boasted. You think that's why my nose is stuffed all the time and why I always feel so chilly? Take my pulse.
Yossarian also worried about Ewing's tumor and melanoma. Catastrophes were lurking everywhere, too numerous to count. When he contemplated the many diseases and potential accidents threatening him, he was positively astounded that he had managed to survive in good health for as long as he had. It was miraculous.
Each day he faced was another dangerous mission against mortality, and he had been surviving them for 28 years. 18. The soldier who saw everything twice. Yossarian owed his good health to exercise, fresh air, teamwork, and good sportsmanship. It was to get away from them all that he had first discovered the hospital. When the physical education officer at Lowry Field ordered everyone to fall out for calisthenics one afternoon, Yossarian, the private, reported instead at the dispensary, with what he said was a pain in his right side.
"Beat it," said the doctor on duty there, who was doing a crossword puzzle. "We can't tell him to beat it," said a corporal. "There's a new directive out about abdominal complaints. We have to keep him under observation 5 days because so many of them have been dying after we make them beat it."
"All right," grumbled the doctor. "Keep him under observation 5 days and then make him beat it."
They took Yossarian's clothes away and put him in a ward where he was very happy when no one was snoring nearby. In the morning, a helpful young English intern popped in to ask him about his liver.
"I think it's my appendix that's bothering me," Yossarian told him.
"Your appendix is no good,"
the Englishman declared with jaunty authority.
"If your appendix goes wrong, we can take it out and have you back on active duty in almost no time at all. But come to us with a liver complaint, and you can fool us for weeks. The liver, you see, is a large, ugly mystery to us. If you've ever eaten liver, you know what I mean. We're pretty sure that the liver exists, and we have a fairly good idea of what it does whenever it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. Beyond that, we're really in the dark. After all, what is a liver?
My father, for example, died of cancer of the liver and was never sick a day of his life, right up till the moment it killed him. Never felt a twinge of pain, in a way that was too bad since I hated my father. Lust for my mother, you know.
What's an English medical officer doing on duty here? Yossarian wanted to know.
The officer laughed. I'll tell you all about that when I see you tomorrow morning. And throw that silly ice bag away before you die of pneumonia. Yossarian never saw him again. That was one of the nice things about all the doctors at the hospital. He never saw any of them a second time. They came and went and simply disappeared. In place of the English intern, the next day there arrived a group of doctors he had never seen before to ask him about his appendix.
"Oh, there's nothing wrong with my appendix," Yossarian informed them. "The doctor yesterday said it was my liver."
"Maybe it is his liver," replied the white-haired officer in charge. "What does his blood count show?"
"He hasn't had a blood count."
"Have one taken right away. We can't afford to take chances with a patient in his condition. We've got to keep ourselves covered in case he dies."
He made a notation on his clipboard and spoke to Yossarian.
"In the meantime, keep that ice bag on. It's very important."
"I don't have an ice bag on."
"Well, get one. There must be an ice bag around here somewhere, and let someone know if the pain becomes unendurable."
At the end of 10 days, a new group of doctors came to Yossarian with bad news. He was in perfect health and had to get out. He was rescued in the nick of time by a patient across the aisle who began to see everything twice. Without warning, the patient sat up in bed and shouted,
"I see everything twice!"
A nurse screamed and an orderly fainted. Doctors came running up from every direction with needles, lights, tubes, rubber mallets, and oscillating metal tines. They rolled up complicated instruments on wheels. There was not enough of the patient to go around, and specialists pushed forward in line with raw tempers and snapped at their colleagues in front to hurry up and give somebody else a chance. A colonel with a large forehead and horn-rimmed glasses soon arrived at a diagnosis.
"It's meningitis," he called out emphatically, waving the others back. "Although Lord knows there's not the slightest reason for thinking so."
"Then why pick meningitis?" inquired a major with a suave chuckle. "Why not, let's say, acute nephritis?"
"Because I'm a meningitis man, that's why, and not an acute nephritis man," retorted the colonel. "And I'm not going to give him up to any of your kidney birds without a struggle. I was here first."
In the end, the doctors were all in accord. They agreed they had no idea what was wrong with the soldier who saw everything twice.
and they rolled him away into a room in the corridor and quarantined everyone else in the ward for 14 days. Thanksgiving Day came and went without any fuss while Yossarian was still in the hospital. The only bad thing about it was the turkey for dinner, and even that was pretty good. It was the most rational Thanksgiving he had ever spent, and he took a sacred oath to spend every future Thanksgiving Day in the cloistered shelter of a hospital. He broke his sacred oath the very next year, when he spent the holiday in a hotel room instead, in intellectual conversation with Lieutenant Shishkov's wife, who had Dory Duz's dog tags on for the occasion, and who henpecked Yossarian sententiously for being cynical and callous about Thanksgiving, even though she didn't believe in God just as much as he didn't.
"I'm probably just as good an atheist as you are," she speculated boastfully. "But even I feel that we all have a great deal to be thankful for, and that we shouldn't be ashamed to show it."
"Name one thing I've got to be thankful for," Yossarian challenged her without interest.
"Well,"
Lieutenant Shishkov's wife mused and paused a moment to ponder dubiously.
"Me?"
"Oh, come on,"
he scoffed. She arched her eyebrows in surprise.
"Aren't you thankful for me?"
she asked. She frowned peevishly, her pride wounded.
"I don't have to shack up with you, you know," she told him with cold dignity. "My husband has a whole squadron full of aviation cadets who would be only too happy to shack up with their commanding officer's wife, just for the added fillip it would give them."
Yossarian decided to change the subject.
"Now you're changing the subject," he pointed out diplomatically. "I'll bet I can name two things to be miserable about for every one you can name to be thankful for."
"Be thankful you've got me," she insisted.
"I am, honey. But I'm also goddamn good and miserable that I can't have Dory Duz again, too. Or the hundreds of other girls and women I'll see and want in my short lifetime and won't be able to go to bed with even once."
"Be thankful you're healthy."
"Be bitter you're not going to stay that way."
"Be glad you're even alive."
"Be furious you're going to die."
"Things could be much worse," she cried.
"They could be one hell of a lot better," he answered heatedly.
"You're naming only one thing," she protested. "You said you could name two."
"And don't tell me God works in mysterious ways," Yossarian continued, hurtling on over her objection. "There's nothing so mysterious about it. He's not working at all. He's playing. Or else he's forgotten all about us. That's the kind of God you people talk about. A country bumpkin, a clumsy, bungling, brainless, conceited, uncouth hayseed. Good God, how much reverence can you have for a supreme being who finds it necessary to include such phenomena as phlegm and tooth decay in his divine system of creation? What in the world was running through that warped, evil, scatological mind of his when he robbed old people of the power to control their bowel movements? Why in the world did he ever create pain?"
"Pain?"
Lieutenant Shishkov's wife pounced upon the word victoriously.
"Pain is a useful symptom. Pain is a warning to us of bodily dangers."
"And who created the dangers?"
Yossarian demanded. He laughed caustically.
"Oh, he was really being charitable to us when he gave us pain. Why couldn't he have used a doorbell instead to notify us, or one of his celestial choirs, or a system of blue and red neon tubes right in the middle of each person's forehead? Any jukebox manufacturer worth his salt could have done that. Why couldn't he?"
"People would certainly look silly walking around with red neon tubes in the middle of their foreheads."
"They certainly look beautiful now, writhing in agony or stupefied with morphine, don't they? What a colossal, immortal blunderer, when you consider the opportunity and power he had to really do a job, and then look at the stupid, ugly little mess he made of it instead. His sheer incompetence is almost staggering. It's obvious he never met a payroll. Why, no self-respecting businessman would hire a bungler like him as even a shipping clerk."
Lieutenant Shishkov's wife had turned ashen in disbelief and was ogling him with alarm.
"You'd better not talk that way about him, honey," she warned him reprovingly in a low and hostile voice.
He might punish you.
Isn't he punishing me enough? Yossarian snorted resentfully. You know, we mustn't let him get away with it. Oh, no! We certainly mustn't let him get away scot-free for all the sorrow he's caused us. Someday I'm going to make him pay. I know when. On the Judgment Day. Yes, that's the day I'll be close enough to reach out and grab that little yokel by his neck and... Stop it! Stop it! Lieutenant Shishkov's wife screamed suddenly and began beating him ineffectually about the head with both fists. Stop it! Yossarian ducked behind his arm for protection while she slammed away at him in feminine fury for a few seconds, and then he caught her determinedly by the wrists and forced her gently back down on the bed.
"What the hell are you getting so upset about?" he asked her bewilderedly in a tone of contrite amusement. "I thought you didn't believe in God."
"I don't," she sobbed, bursting violently into tears. "But the God I don't believe in is a good God. A just God, a merciful God. He's not the mean and stupid God you make him out to be."
Yossarian laughed and turned her arms loose.
"Let's have a little more religious freedom between us," he proposed obligingly. "You don't believe in the God you want to, and I won't believe in the God I want to. Is that a deal?"
That was the most illogical Thanksgiving he could ever remember spending. And his thoughts turned wishfully to his halcyon 14-day quarantine in the hospital the year before. But even that idyll had ended on a tragic note. He was still in good health when the quarantine period was over, and they told him again that he had to get out and go to war. Yossarian sat up in bed when he heard the bad news and shouted,
"I see everything twice!"
Pandemonium broke loose in the ward again. The specialists came running up from all directions and ringed him in a circle of scrutiny so confining that he could feel the humid breath from the various noses blowing uncomfortably upon the different sectors of his body. They went snooping into his eyes and ears with tiny beams of light, assaulted his legs and feet with rubber hammers and vibrating forks, drew blood from his veins, held anything handy up for him to see on the periphery of his vision. The leader of this team of doctors was a dignified, solicitous gentleman who held one finger up directly in front of Yossarian and demanded,
"How many fingers do you see?"
"Two,"
Yossarian said.
"How many fingers do you see now?" asked the doctor, holding up two.
"Two," said Yossarian.
"And how many now?"
asked the doctor, holding up none.
"Two,"
said Yossarian. The doctor's face wreathed with a smile.
"By Jove, he's right," he declared jubilantly. "He does see everything twice."
They rolled Yossarian away on a stretcher into the room with the other soldier who saw everything twice and quarantined everyone else in the ward for another 14 days.
"I see everything twice,"
the soldier who saw everything twice shouted when they rolled Yossarian in.
"I see everything twice!"
Yossarian shouted back at him just as loudly with a secret wink.
"The walls! The walls!" the other soldier cried. "Move back the walls!"
"The walls! The walls!" Yossarian cried. "Move back the walls!"
One of the doctors pretended to shove the wall back.
"Is that far enough?"
The soldier who saw everything twice nodded weakly and sank back on his bed. Yossarian nodded weakly, too, eyeing his talented roommate with great humility and admiration. He knew he was in the presence of a master. His talented roommate was obviously a person to be studied and emulated. During the night, his talented roommate died, and Yossarian decided that he had followed him far enough.
"I see everything once!"
he cried quickly. A new group of specialists came pounding up to his bedside with their instruments to find out if it was true.
"How many fingers do you see?" asked the leader, holding up one.
"One."
The doctor held up two fingers.
"How many fingers do you see now?"
"One."
The doctor held up 10 fingers.
"And how many now?"
"One."
The doctor turned to the other doctors with amazement.
"He does see everything once," he exclaimed. "We made him all better."
"And just in time, too,"
announced the doctor with whom Yossarian next found himself alone, a tall, torpedo-shaped, congenial man with an unshaven growth of brown beard and a pack of cigarettes in his shirt pocket that he chain-smoked insouciantly as he leaned against the wall.
"There are some relatives here to see you. Oh, don't worry," he added with a laugh. "Not your relatives. It's the mother, father, and brother of that chap who died. They've traveled all the way from New York to see a dying soldier, and you're the handiest one we've got."
"What are you talking about?" Yossarian asked suspiciously. "I'm not dying."
"Of course you're dying. We're all dying. Where the devil else do you think you're heading?"
"They didn't come to see me," Yossarian objected. "They came to see their son."
"They'll have to take what they can get. As far as we're concerned, one dying boy is just as good as any other, or just as bad. To a scientist, all dying boys are equal. I have a proposition for you. You let them come in and look you over for a few minutes, and I won't tell anyone you've been lying about your liver symptoms."
Yossarian drew back from him farther.
"You know about that?" "Of course I do. Give us some credit."
The doctor chuckled amiably and lit another cigarette.
"How do you expect anyone to believe you have a liver condition if you keep squeezing the nurse's tits every time you get a chance? You're going to have to give up sex if you want to convince people you've got an ailing liver."
"That's a hell of a price to pay just to keep alive. Why didn't you turn me in if you knew I was faking?"
"Why the devil should I?" asked the doctor with a flicker of surprise. "We're all in this business of illusion together. I'm always willing to lend a helping hand to a fellow conspirator along the road to survival if he's willing to do the same for me. These people have come a long way, and I'd rather not disappoint them. I'm sentimental about old people."
"But they came to see their son."
"They came too late. Maybe they won't even notice the difference."
"Suppose they start crying?"
"They probably will start crying. That's one of the reasons they came. I'll listen outside the door and break it up if it starts getting tacky."
"It all sounds a bit crazy," Yossarian reflected. "What do they want to watch their son die for, anyway?"
"I've never been able to figure that one out," the doctor admitted. "But they always do. Well, what do you say? All you got to do is lie there a few minutes and die a little. Is that asking so much?"
"All right," Yossarian gave in. "If it's just for a few minutes and you promise to wait right outside."
He warmed to his role.
"Say, why don't you wrap a bandage around me for effect?"
"That sounds like a splendid idea," applauded the doctor.
They wrapped a batch of bandages around Yossarian. A team of medical orderlies installed tan shades on each of the two windows and lowered them to douse the room in depressing shadows. Yossarian suggested flowers, and the doctor sent an orderly out to find two small bunches of fading ones with a strong and sickening smell. When everything was in place, they made Yossarian get back into bed and lie down. Then they admitted the visitors. The visitors entered uncertainly, as though they felt they were intruding, tiptoeing in with stares of meek apology. First the grieving mother and father, then the brother, a glowering, heavy-set sailor with a deep chest. The man and woman stepped into the room stiffly, side by side, as though right out of a familiar, though esoteric, anniversary daguerreotype on a wall. They were both short, sere, and proud. They seemed made of iron and old, dark clothing. The woman had a long, brooding, oval face of burnt umber, with coarse, graying black hair parted severely in the middle and combed back austerely behind her neck without curl, wave, or ornamentation. Her mouth was sullen and sad, her lined lips compressed. The father stood very rigid and quaint in a double-breasted suit with padded shoulders that were much too tight for him. He was broad and muscular, on a small scale, and had a magnificently curled silver mustache on his crinkled face. His eyes were creased and rheumy. and he appeared tragically ill at ease as he stood awkwardly with the brim of his black felt fedora held in his two brawny laborer's hands out in front of his wide lapels. Poverty and hard work had inflicted iniquitous damage on both. The brother was looking for a fight. His round white cap was cocked at an insolent tilt, his hands were clenched, and he glared at everything in the room with a scowl of injured truculence. The three creaked forward timidly, holding themselves close to each other in a stealthy funereal group and inching forward almost in step, until they arrived at the side of the bed and stood staring down at Yossarian. There was a gruesome and excruciating silence that threatened to endure forever. Finally, Yossarian was unable to bear it any longer and cleared his throat. The old man spoke at last.
"He looks terrible," he said.
"He's sick, Pa."
"Giuseppe,"
said the mother, who had seated herself in a chair with her veiny fingers clasped in her lap.
"My name is Yossarian," Yossarian said.
"His name is Yossarian, Ma." "Yossarian, don't you recognize me? I'm your brother John. Don't you know who I am?"
"Sure I do. You're my brother John."
He does recognize me. "Pa, he knows who I am."
"Yossarian?
Here's Papa. Say hello to Papa."
"Hello, Papa," said Yossarian. "Hello, Giuseppe.
His name is Yossarian, Pa."
"Can't get over how terrible he looks," the father said.
"He's very sick, Pa. The doctor says he's going to die."
"I didn't know whether to believe the doctor or not," the father said. "You know how crooked those guys are."
"Giuseppe,"
the mother said again in a soft, broken chord of muted anguish.
"His name is Yossarian, Ma. She don't remember things too good anymore. How are they treating you in here, kid? They treating you pretty good?"
"Pretty good," Yossarian told him.
"That's good. Just don't let anybody in here push you around. You're just as good as anybody else in here, even though you're Italian. You got rights, too."
Yossarian winced and closed his eyes so that he would not have to look at his brother John. He began to feel sick.
"Now, see how terrible he looks," the father observed.
"Giuseppe,"
the mother said.
"Ma, his name is Yossarian,"
the brother interrupted her impatiently.
"Can't you remember?" "It's all right,"
Yossarian interrupted him.
"She can call me Giuseppe if she wants to."
"Giuseppe,"
she said to him.
"Don't worry, Yossarian,"
the brother said.
"Everything's going to be all right."
"Don't worry, Ma,"
Yossarian said.
"Everything's going to be all right."
"Did you have a priest?"
the brother wanted to know.
"Yes,"
Yossarian lied, wincing again.
"That's good,"
the brother decided.
"Just as long as you're getting everything you got coming to you. We came all the way from New York. We're afraid we wouldn't get here in time."
"In time for what?"
"In time to see you before you died."
"What difference would it make?"
"We didn't want you to die by yourself."
"What difference would it make?"
"You must be getting delirious," the brother said. "You keep saying the same thing over and over again."
"That's really very funny,"
the old man replied.
"All of the time, I thought his name was Giuseppe. And now I find out his name is Yossarian. That's really very funny."
"Ma, make him feel good,"
the brother urged.
"Say something to cheer him up."
"Giuseppe."
"It's not Giuseppe, Ma. It's Yossarian."
"What difference does it make?"
the mother answered in the same mourning tone without looking up.
"He's dying."
Her humid eyes filled with tears, and she began to cry, rocking back and forth slowly in her chair with her hands lying in her lap like fallen moths. Yossarian was afraid she would start wailing. The father and brother began crying also. Yossarian remembered suddenly why they were all crying, and he began crying, too. A doctor Yossarian had never seen before stepped inside the room and told the visitors courteously that they had to go. The father drew himself up formally to say goodbye.
"Giuseppe," he began.
"Yossarian,"
corrected the son.
Yossarian, said the father.
Giuseppe,
corrected Yossarian.
Soon you're going to die.
Yossarian began to cry again. The doctor threw him a dirty look from the rear of the room, and Yossarian made himself stop. The father continued solemnly with his head lowered.
When you talk to the man upstairs, he said, I want you to tell him something for me. Tell him it ain't the right for people to die when they're young. I mean it. Tell him if they gotta die at all, they gotta die when they're old. I want you to tell him that. I don't think he knows it ain't right, 'cause he's supposed to be good, and it's been going on for a long, long time. Okay? And don't let anybody up there push you around, the brother advised. You'll be just as good as anybody else in heaven, even though you're Italian.
There's a warm, said the mother,
who seemed to know. 19. Colonel Cathcart. Colonel Cathcart was a slick, successful, slipshod, unhappy man of 36, who lumbered when he walked and wanted to be a general. He was dashing and dejected, poised and chagrined. He was complacent and insecure, daring in the administrative stratagems he employed to bring himself to the attention of his superiors, and craven in his concern that his schemes might all backfire. He was handsome and unattractive, a swashbuckling, beefy, conceited man who was putting on fat and was tormented chronically by prolonged seizures of apprehension. Colonel Cathcart was conceited because he was a full colonel with a combat command at the age of only 36, and Colonel Cathcart was dejected because although he was already 36, he was still only a full colonel. Colonel Cathcart was impervious to absolutes. He could measure his own progress only in relationship to others, and his idea of excellence was to do something at least as well as all the men his own age who were doing the same thing even better. The fact that there were thousands of men his own age and older who had not even attained the rank of major enlivened him with foppish delight in his own remarkable worth. On the other hand, the fact that there were men of his own age and younger who were already generals contaminated him with an agonizing sense of failure, and made him gnaw at his fingernails with an unappeasable anxiety that was even more intense than Hungry Joe's. Colonel Cathcart was a very large, pouting, broad-shouldered man, with close-cropped, curly dark hair that was graying at the tips, and an ornate cigarette holder that he purchased the day before he arrived in Pianosa to take command of his group. He displayed the cigarette holder grandly on every occasion, and had learned to manipulate it adroitly. Unwittingly, he had discovered deep within himself a fertile aptitude for smoking with a cigarette holder. As far as he could tell, his was the only cigarette holder in the whole Mediterranean theater of operations, and the thought was both flattering and disquieting. He had no doubts at all that someone as debonair and intellectual as General Peckham approved of his smoking with a cigarette holder, even though the two were in each other's presence rather seldom, which, in a way, was very lucky, Colonel Cathcart recognized with relief, since General Peckham might not have approved of his cigarette holder at all. When such misgivings assailed Colonel Cathcart, he choked back a sob and wanted to throw the damn thing away, but he was restrained by his unswerving conviction that the cigarette holder never failed to embellish his masculine, martial physique with a high gloss of sophisticated heroism that illuminated him to dazzling advantage among all the other full colonels in the American Army with whom he was in competition. Although how could he be sure? Colonel Cathcart was indefatigable that way, an industrious, intense, dedicated military tactician who calculated day and night in the service of himself. He was his own sarcophagus, a bold and infallible diplomat who was always berating himself disgustedly for all the chances he had missed and kicking himself regretfully for all the errors he had made. He was tense, irritable, bitter, and smug. He was a valorous opportunist who pounced hoggishly upon every opportunity Colonel Korn discovered for him, and trembled in damp despair immediately afterward at the possible consequences he might suffer. He collected rumors greedily and treasured gossip. He believed all the news he heard, and had faith in none. He was on the alert constantly for every signal, shrewdly sensitive to relationships and situations that did not exist. He was someone in the know who was always striving pathetically to find out what was going on. He was a blustering, intrepid bully who brooded inconsolably over the terrible, ineradicable impressions he knew he kept making on people of prominence who were scarcely aware that he was even alive. Everybody was persecuting him. Colonel Cathcart lived by his wits in an unstable, arithmetical world of black eyes and feathers in his cap, of overwhelming imaginary triumphs and catastrophic imaginary defeats. He oscillated hourly between anguish and exhilaration, multiplying fantastically the grandeur of his victories and exaggerating tragically the seriousness of his defeats. Nobody ever caught him napping. If word reached him that General Dreagle or General Peckham had been seen smiling, frowning, or doing neither, he could not make himself rest until he had found an acceptable interpretation and grumbled mulishly until Colonel Korn persuaded him to relax and take things easy. Lieutenant Colonel Korn was a loyal, indispensable ally who got on Colonel Cathcart's nerves. Colonel Cathcart pledged eternal gratitude to Colonel Korn for the ingenious moves he devised, and was furious with him afterward when he realized they might not work. Colonel Cathcart was greatly indebted to Colonel Korn, and did not like him at all. The two were very close. Colonel Cathcart was jealous of Colonel Korn's intelligence, and had to remind himself often that Colonel Korn was still only a lieutenant colonel, even though he was almost 10 years older than Colonel Cathcart, and that Colonel Korn had obtained his education at a state university. Colonel Cathcart bewailed the miserable fate that had given him for an invaluable assistant someone as common as Colonel Korn. It was degrading to have to depend so thoroughly on a person who had been educated at a state university. If someone did have to become indispensable to him, Colonel Cathcart lamented, it could just as easily have been someone wealthy and well-groomed, someone from a better family, who was more mature than Colonel Korn, and who did not treat Colonel Cathcart's desire to become a general as frivolously as Colonel Cathcart secretly suspected Colonel Korn secretly did. Cathcart wanted to be a general so desperately he was willing to try anything, even religion, and he summoned the chaplain to his office late one morning the week after he had raised the number of missions to 60 and pointed abruptly down toward his desk to his copy of the Saturday Evening Post. The colonel wore his khaki shirt collar wide open, exposing a shadow of tough black bristles of beard on his egg-white neck, and had a spongy, hanging underlip. He was a person who never tanned, and he kept out of the sun as much as possible to avoid burning. The colonel was more than a head taller than the chaplain, and over twice as broad, and his swollen, overbearing authority made the chaplain feel frail and sickly by contrast.
"Take a look, chaplain,"
Colonel Cathcart directed, screwing a cigarette into his holder and seating himself affluently in the swivel chair behind his desk.
"Let me know what you think."
The chaplain looked down at the open magazine compliantly and saw an editorial spread dealing with an American bomber group in England whose chaplain said prayers in the briefing room before each mission. The chaplain almost wept with happiness when he realized the colonel was not going to holler at him. The two had hardly spoken since the tumultuous evening Colonel Cathcart had thrown him out of the officers' club at General Dreidel's bidding after Chief White Halfoat had punched Colonel Mudus in the nose. The chaplain's initial fear had been that the colonel intended reprimanding him for having gone back into the officers' club without permission the evening before. He had gone there with Yossarian and Dunbar after the two had come unexpectedly to his tent in the clearing in the woods to ask him to join them. Intimidated as he was by Colonel Cathcart, he nevertheless found it easier to brave his displeasure than to decline the thoughtful invitation of his two new friends, whom he had met on one of his hospital visits just a few weeks before, and who had worked so effectively to insulate him against the myriad social vicissitudes involved in his official duty to live on closest terms of familiarity with more than 900 unfamiliar officers and enlisted men who thought him an odd duck. The chaplain glued his eyes to the pages of the magazine. He studied each photograph twice and read the captions intently as he organized his response to the colonel's question into a grammatically complete sentence that he rehearsed and reorganized in his mind a considerable number of times before he was able finally to muster the courage to reply.
"I think that saying prayers before each mission is a very moral and highly laudatory procedure, sir," he offered timidly, and waited.
"Yeah," said the colonel, "but I want to know if you think they'll work here."
"Yes, sir," answered the chaplain after a few moments. "I should think they would."
"Then I'd like to give it a try."
The colonel's ponderous, farinaceous cheeks were tinted suddenly with glowing patches of enthusiasm. He rose to his feet and began walking around excitedly.
"Look how much good they've done for these people in England. Here's a picture of a colonel in the Saturday Evening Post whose chaplain conducts prayers before each mission. If the prayers work for him, they should work for us. Maybe if we say prayers, I'll put my picture in the Saturday Evening Post."
The colonel sat down again and smiled distantly in lavish contemplation. The chaplain had no hint of what he was expected to say next. With a pensive expression on his oblong, rather pale face, he allowed his gaze to settle on several of the high bushels filled with red plum tomatoes that stood in rows against each of the walls. He pretended to concentrate on a reply. After a while, he realized that he was staring at rows and rows of bushels of red plum tomatoes, and grew so intrigued by the question of what bushels brimming with red plum tomatoes were doing in a group commander's office that he forgot completely about the discussion of prayer meetings, until Colonel Cathcart, in a genial digression, inquired.
"Would you like to buy some, Chaplain? They come right off the farm Colonel Corn and I have up in the hills. I can let you have a bushel wholesale."
"Oh, no, sir, I don't think so."
"That's quite all right,"
the colonel assured him liberally.
"You don't have to. Milo is glad to snap up all we can produce. These were picked only yesterday. Notice how firm and ripe they are, like a young girl's breasts."
The chaplain blushed, and the colonel understood at once that he had made a mistake. He lowered his head in shame, his cumbersome face burning. His fingers felt gross and unwieldy. He hated the chaplain venomously for being a chaplain, and making a coarse blunder out of an observation that in any other circumstances, he knew, would have been considered witty and urbane. He tried miserably to recall some means of extricating them both from their devastating embarrassment. He recalled instead that the chaplain was only a captain, and he straightened at once with a shocked and outraged gasp. His cheeks grew tight with fury at the thought that he had just been duped into humiliation by a man who was almost the same age as he was and still only a captain. And he swung upon the chaplain avengingly with a look of such murderous antagonism that the chaplain began to tremble. The colonel punished him sadistically with a long, glowering, malignant, hateful, silent stare.
"We were speaking about something else,"
he reminded the chaplain cuttingly at last.
"We were not speaking about the firm, ripe breasts of young girls, but about something else entirely.
We were speaking about conducting religious services in the briefing room before each mission. Is there any reason why we can't?
No, sir, the chaplain mumbled.
Then we'll begin with this afternoon's mission.
The colonel's hostility softened gradually as he applied himself to details.
Now, I want you to give a lot of thought to the kind of prayers we're going to say. I don't want anything heavy or sad. I'd like you to keep it light and snappy, something that will send the boys out feeling pretty good. Do you know what I mean? I don't want any of this Kingdom of God or Valley of Death stuff. That's all too negative. What are you making such a sour face for?
I'm sorry, sir, the chaplain stammered. Happened to be thinking of the 23rd Psalm, just as you said that.
How does that one go?
That's the one you were just referring to, sir. The Lord is my shepherd, I...
That's the one I was just referring to. It's out. What else have you got?
Save me, O God, for the waters are come in unto...
No waters,
the colonel decided, blowing ruggedly into his cigarette holder after flipping the butt down into his combed brass ashtray.
Why don't we try something musical? How about the harps on the willows?
That has the rivers of Babylon in it, sir, the chaplain replied. There we sat down, yea, we wept, when we remembered Zion.
Zion, forget about that one right now. I'd like to know how that one even got in there. Haven't you got anything humorous that stays away from waters and valleys and God? I'd like to keep away from the subject of religion altogether, if we can.
The chaplain was apologetic.
I'm sorry, sir, but just about all the prayers I know are rather somber in tone and make at least some passing reference to God.
Then let's get some new ones. The men are already doing enough bitching about the missions I send them on without our rubbing it in with any sermons about God or death or paradise. Why can't we take a more positive approach? Why can't we all pray for something good? Like a tighter bomb pattern, for example. Couldn't we pray for a tighter bomb pattern?
Well, yes, sir, I suppose so, the chaplain answered hesitantly. You wouldn't even need me if that's all you wanted to do. You could do that yourself.
I know I could, the colonel responded tartly. But what do you think you're here for? I could shop for my own food, too, but that's Milo's job, and that's why he's doing it for every group in the area. Your job is to lead us in prayer. And from now on, you're going to lead us in a prayer for a tighter bomb pattern before every mission. Is that clear? I think a tighter bomb pattern is something really worth praying for. It will be a feather in all our caps with General Peckham. General Peckham feels it makes a much nicer aerial photograph when the bombs explode close together.
General Peckham, sir?
That's right, Chaplain,
the colonel replied, chuckling paternally at the chaplain's look of puzzlement.
I wouldn't want this to get around, but it looks like General Dreidel is finally on the way out, and the General Peckham is slated to replace him. Frankly, I'm not going to be sorry to see that happen. General Peckham's a very good man, and I think we'll all be much better off under him. On the other hand, it might never take place, and we'll still remain under General Dreidel. Frankly, I wouldn't be sorry to see that happen either. Because General Dreidel is another very good man. I think we'd all be much better off under him, too. I hope you're going to keep all this under your hat, Chaplain. I wouldn't want either one to get the idea I was throwing my support on the side of the other.
Yes, sir.
That's good,
the colonel exclaimed and stood up jovially.
But all this gossip isn't getting us into the Saturday Evening Post, eh, Chaplain? Let's see what kind of procedure we can evolve. Incidentally, Chaplain, not a word about this beforehand to Colonel Korn. You understand?
Yes, sir.
Colonel Cathcart began tramping back and forth reflectively in the narrow corridors left between his bushels of plum tomatoes and the desk and wooden chairs in the center of the room.
I suppose we'll have to keep you waiting outside until the briefing is over, because all that information is classified. We can slip you in while Major Danby is synchronizing the watches. I don't think there's anything secret about the right time. We'll allocate about a minute and a half for you in the schedule. Will a minute and a half be enough?
Yes, sir. If it doesn't include the time necessary to excuse the atheists from the room and admit the enlisted men.
Colonel Cathcart stopped in his tracks.
What atheists?
He bellowed defensively, his whole manner changing in a flash to one of virtuous and belligerent denial.
There are no atheists in my outfit. Atheism is against the law, isn't it?
No, sir.
It isn't.
The colonel was surprised.